Hey there, I'm Ed Ronco, and this is the Up North Lowdown from Interlaken Public Radio. A little later in the program, we will hear from comedian and actor Mark Maron. But we're jumping right in with an update on the ice storms here in northern Michigan. It has been about 2 weeks since our region was encased in ice, since the trees snapped, since the power lines fell. And as I am recording this, the lights are back on for many, and still off for some. And now the attention is shifting to long-term recovery. IPR's Michael Livingston visited some of the storm-damaged area at the end of last week, and he found warming centers that were still open, but definitely had fewer people inside. Here he is in Harbor Springs.
Shea Elementary School served as one of the busiest warming stations in the area. City police officers are stationed at the front entrance. They keep a list of names in front of stacks of water bottles. Nurses with the American Red Cross brought dozens of cots that line the school's cafeteria. The people who had to stay the night were mostly elders. That's because a housing community for low-income seniors called the Village of Hillside lost power. Some had to come here to power oxygen machines or get medication. Matthew Bush is Hillside Service Coordinator.
Nobody wants to leave home and sleep in a school with all these people. But I think they've come accustomed to it. I mean, they've come to realize that there's not much of a choice. It's either that or be very, very cold.
Some utility companies predicted multiple week outages for some parts of northern Michigan. Some of the people who live in more backcountry areas of Emmett County said they have no idea when power will come back on at their homes. Despite this, the attitude at Shea Elementary is positive, especially among the volunteers.
It's been overwhelming in like a really great way, but also just a really devastating way at the same time.
That's Jessica Mills. She's a fourth grade teacher at Shea Elementary, but for the past week, she's been helping coordinate this shelter.
Initially, I was just watching the door to let people in and make sure they got settled and answer questions. Since then, I was kind of made the point person, so I have been like relayed information just to communicate to all the volunteers and the people in the kitchen, and we've had an amazing kitchen staff.
That kitchen staff comes from restaurants in downtown Harbor Springs. They've been serving 3 free hot meals a day since the shelter opened.
Everyone has been helping. Like, the police officers' wives have all been in. Their parents, my parents, like, the whole community has really just come together. We couldn't have done it without every single other person.
Mills says she's eager for recovery to begin, and that she hopes her school reopens soon. Helping out has been a good distraction, but she's eager to check in on all her students she hasn't seen in days. Some of their families, Mills says, will deal with the aftermath of this storm for months.
IPR's Michael Livingston reporting from Harbor Springs. So let's talk about that aftermath. The recovery work definitely will continue for a while yet, but utility companies are thinking about what comes next. Climate change means this probably won't be the last time we see extreme ice weather. Utilities are trying to figure out how to be ready. Here's IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross.
David Tome has one of those jobs where sometimes, unexpectedly, the phone rings late at night.
It was 11 o'clock at night. I got a phone call from the Emmett County Sheriff's Department, and they asked, hey, you know, do you guys have access to chainsaws?
He's the Safety and Emergency Management Director for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians in Harbor Springs. They put those chainsaws to use over the following week, clearing trees from roads and power lines damaged by the ice. That damage, Tome says, was remarkable.
It looked, in some places, it looked like a plane had come through and just crash-landed through the woods because of how evenly the trees had snapped off.
He lives on a horse farm, and during the storm, a generator powered his house, but it wasn't strong enough to pump water for the horses. So they had to set up garbage pails to catch rain for them. The storm was a lot for people who live here, and for those who bring them power.
It was just a crushing impact on the trees and the electric infrastructure.
Greg Salisbury is the vice president of electric engineering at Consumers Energy, the state's second largest utility. Their staff meteorologist warned them of the storm, and they had 4 days to bring in extra crews and set up response centers. Despite that, 126,000 northern Michigan customers lost power over the week. Salisbury says such extreme weather will damage even the best infrastructure.
That's beyond the realm of even our latest and strongest design standards that we've now had in place for the last 3 years.
A couple years ago, the nonprofit Climate Central said Michigan is among the states with the most weather-related outages. And climate scientists expect ice storms to become more common here. So with problems already and more weather on the way, how should utilities adapt? The people we talked to said in the short term, it's about forecasting and response. In the long term, it's about grid upgrades and, for some, policy changes. Let's break all that down. Salisbury says Consumers has been working on what they call a reliability roadmap. That includes prevention measures like trimming trees, installing taller poles, and better monitoring for outages.
These are very expensive events for our customers to pay for when we have to fix things after they break. It is much, much cheaper, at least 50% cheaper, for us to do this work of hardening and automating and in some cases burying electric lines in advance with a plan.
Salisbury says in rural areas, burying electric lines can be relatively fast and simple and is often the best approach. But it's still expensive, and utilities have come under scrutiny for poor performance, even as they've increased rates. Just last month, the Michigan Public Service Commission approved a rate increase of nearly $154 million for Consumers Energy. That's expected to increase customer bills by about 3%. The money will go toward reducing outages and improving the grid. But critics, like Attorney General Dana Nessel, argue that regularly raising costs isn't fair to customers, and that it's allowing utilities to ask for more money before people can evaluate the impact of previous rate hikes. Jonathan Overpeck is the dean of the University of Michigan's Environment and Sustainability School. He says big investor-owned utilities have to answer to their shareholders, and that doesn't always align with what's best for their customers or the climate.
They have to either provide the service the public needs, or the public has to demand a better model. And I think that's the tension that's going on right now. And it's distorted by money, of course. Everyone has their lobbyists, but particularly investor-owned utilities have more money to lobby with and things. So it gets really difficult.
He thinks there should be more incentives and regulations for utilities to not only improve reliability, but also move toward electrification. Preparing for extreme weather might also require more out-of-the-box thinking, such as new forms of power generation and distribution. Some of those ideas, he says, haven't really caught on in Michigan yet. Still, utilities are in a tough position. Seth Geikma is a professor at the University of Michigan, and just a note, part of his research is funded by Consumers Energy.
Utilities face the really hardest question of, we have these lines going all over the place. Where do we actually allocate the limited funds we have? How do we set priorities? And that's a really hard question that we don't currently have a lot of good methods for.
He says at some point, somebody's going to have to spend more money to make a more resilient grid.
The question is, who's going to spend that?
And Overpeck, the University of Michigan dean, says answering those questions is urgent.
IPR's Izzy Ross. Her work comes to us through a partnership with Grist. One more piece of news. Governor Gretchen Whitmer's office requested an emergency declaration this week from President Donald Trump. The declaration would not include help from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, but it would make up to $5 million available to support recovery efforts. State officials are also pursuing FEMA assistance, but they need to conduct damage assessments first, and those are set to begin the week of April 20th. The Up North Lowdown. We'll be right back.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Welcome back to the Up North Lowdown. I'm Ed Ronco. The Traverse City Comedy Fest is happening the weekend we are recording this, and their headliner is Marc Maron.
I think on a deeper level, the reason we're not more upset about the world ending environmentally is I think all of us in our hearts really know that we did everything we could. You know, we really, right? I mean, we really did. I mean, think about it. We brought our own bags to the supermarket. Yeah, that's about it. Like, we brought the bags right when they told us. We brought them, and it just wasn't enough, it turns out. Just not enough.
Marc Maron has millions of fans. He's made over 1,400 episodes of his podcast series, WTF. And ahead of the Traverse City Comedy Fest, he spoke with IPR arts and culture contributor, Joe Beyer.
For someone who maybe knows your work from the podcast or from television and films, who has never seen you do stand-up in person, what would you say is the best part of a night out with Marc Maron?
Well, I think if you are somebody who is a little heady and a little nervous and a little, intelligent and sensitive to the world and yourself, that I can definitely entertain you very thoroughly. Generally, the structure of my longer sets has become sort of establishing up front where I stand culturally and politically to a certain degree, primarily as a service to myself, but also to the people that know me, to feel like they're seen and part of a community. And then, I've got into some, fast-paced storytelling. Some of it is lighthearted, and I pace it so there is a feeling of like, well, this is heavy and, oh, that's fun. This is challenging. Oh, but this is fun. Oh, this is nice. So there is a wide variety of material that I'm doing that sort of services the spectrum of what I'm explaining to you. If you're looking for dumb comedy, I'm not your guy. If you're looking for easy laughs, there's a lot of laughs. And some of them are easier than others, but I am who I am. I'm at that age now where I'm not an arena act and I'm not a TikTok sensation. So, people got to know me for what they know me for and, and show up. I'm not chasing it as much as I used to.
You make it sound, though, like, you're handing out flyers on the corner. I mean, you're doing all right.
There you go. Well, that's that dumb humility I have by not really acknowledging my place in the world.
Your latest tour is called All In, which kind of sounds to me like maybe a potential epitaph for you, honestly, because you do so many things. It's one of the most impressive parts of your career. You're an actor, writer, producer, a musician, a guitar legend. How, at this point, do you keep track of flipping all of those hats, or is it just one big hat now?
Well, each thing happens in its own time frame, right? Things are put in place, and there are certain jobs. Like, I don't really know what's coming up 2 weeks from now. My brain just doesn't do it. So in that way, it enables me to not necessarily compartmentalize, but certainly be surprised, have to do things that, I haven't been thinking about, but require, my full attention. And the podcast, that's a job that, has a schedule. And touring is a little more erratic. And the priorities are really, always have been the comedy and the podcast. And, I've integrated that into my being. And music is sort of a hobby. I don't have to do that. I don't have to do that professionally. I'm kind of trying to put in place the possibility to direct a film based on my buddy's book, and we've begun that work. But I try not to fester about, what's really happening, and I choose to let my brain just worry about things that aren't.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the podcast, which for those that don't know, launched in 2009, I believe. And you have millions and millions of listeners, and just about every interesting person in arts and culture has come on and done your show now. As you look back, do you have any sense of what has made WTF such a cultural juggernaut and why it's had so much impact? Do you even let yourself think about something like that?
No, I don't, you know, the numbers, I don't know, you know, like I base all my opinions on, you know, random, you know, emails and, you know, a few posts on social media platforms. But, you know, and I don't really know, you know, my impact in the macro, you know, in the micro, I hear from people who have been, you know, profoundly affected by my show, and it's helped in a lot of ways. And I think it set a tone and a structure for the future of podcasting, for better or for worse. So I have some sense of my impact historically in the medium, but I'm not always really clear on, you know, my status in the world, which is probably better off. It keeps me humble.
This interview is going to be for Interlochen Public Radio, which is on the campus of Interlochen Center for the Arts up here in northern Michigan. I know you've been to Michigan several times. And Interlochen is a place where young people come from all over the world, basically, to study their passion. And I'm wondering if at this point, and your concern about the future of this country and people, would you be able to channel that into any kind of advice or mentorship for this generation of storytellers, I guess?
Well, I you know, things have changed a great deal in terms of how one gets their particular form of expression out there. And, you know, I'm pretty old school in terms of how I approach my craft. But I think that, you know, if you are possessed by a vision for whatever mode of expression you are practicing, that, you know, the desire for attention that is, you know, facilitated by outlets that are fundamentally concerned with their own financial bottom line, creates a context by which people can express themselves that is limited to the framework of basically serving a corporate overlord that is facilitating your ability to get seen. And I would be careful in terms of what kind of compromises you're making to your particular vision. And if you are framing your vision in order to serve this particular delivery system, then you might want to consider what your art is really. Like, I think that the desire for attention and the desire for clicks and the desire for monetizing or finding an audience that I think is ultimately fleeting and really based on you know, ticket numbers or attention, as long as you're working to facilitate, you know, to manifest what is truly your vision of expression, then that's fine. But I think it's very easy to get sucked into the kind of constant creation of short form trivialities in order to maintain that attention without much foresight. So if that wasn't too convoluted, I think that made sense.
That's Mark Maron speaking with IPR arts and culture contributor Joe Beyer. You can find a transcript of their longer conversation through our website, iprnews.org. That's it for the Lowdown this week. We had contributions from Michael Livingston, Izzy Ross, and Ellie Katz. I'm Ed Ronco. Our producer is Max Copeland. Our music comes from Blue Dot Sessions. And the rest of it comes from, well, you. We are just wrapping up our spring fund drive for listener support. Thanks to all who gave. It is not too late to donate to Interlochen Public Radio. Go to iprnews.org and make a donation in support of all the work we do here, including the Up North Lowdown. Our sonic send-off this week is related to some good news we heard. The ice storms caused a lot of damage, but they somehow spared the jack pine forests of central and eastern northern Michigan. That is crucial habitat for a bird called the Kirtland's warbler. It is a little gray and yellow bird that was once on the brink of extinction. It is also a favorite to be Michigan's state bird. Yeah, we have the robin, but a lot of people want the warbler. This thing is beloved. So, we leave you now with the song of the Kirtland's warbler from the online bird call database, Xenocanto. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.